Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD.
Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Osiris.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Undermine Season 4. We're in Episode 8. I can't believe we're already in Episode 8. I'm Tom Marshall, and I'm also your fish tour guide as we travel back in time to Destination 1.0. This season, we'll be visiting several shows from the early and mid-90s on Fish's Road to the tour that changed everything, Fall 1997. And when we arrive there, we'll stop and look at every show of that tour on the show's anniversary. We're honored to be your companion on this ride as we all go back and listen to those groundbreaking shows. My co-host for today is Osiris co-founder and HF Pod host, RJB. Hi, RJ. How are you?
Hey, Tom. I'm good. We have an amazing episode today and a guest who we work with almost every day. And so we're gonna talk about that in a second. But first, Tom and I just wanted to say something. We had a good friend and coworker from Osiris, Brad Stratton, who passed away suddenly the other day. He was the lead audio engineer on Sugar Maple and our show we did with Lit called My Own Worst Enemy, Breaking Wave Seattle, many, many shows. He was an amazing guy and really helped us, I think, learn a lot and up our game about audio. And we wouldn't be where we are without him. And so we just want to say that, you know, rest in peace, Brad. And Brad was a big lover of beer. I had a lot of beers with him over the years. And so I just want to, I have a beer for this episode and I just want to make a toast. I think Tom does as well.
I have a beer as well. And I'd also like to say Brad was a perfectionist and everything that he was involved with, he made sure was as good as possible. He never, ever compromised. And you can hear it in his work. He was part of what made our podcast good, and we're going to miss him. And rest in peace, Brad, and we're thinking about you and your family.
Cheers. Okay, so Tom, today we are talking about what I think is a seminal moment in Fish history. It's when a New Year's Eve run that kind of elevated this whole career, I think, setting a new precedent for New Year's Eve, setting a new precedent for the band, raising the bar for them in a lot of ways. So we're going to travel back in time to Worcester, Mass on December 31st, 1993. There was a lot that was special about this particular New Year's Eve, as well as the night before, 12:30 from Portland, Maine. This was a radio broadcast. I remember the tapes that I had because of the radio broadcast. The sound was crystal clear. And after the opening llama, Trey says, "Everybody in yet?" And it's just like, it's so, when I listen back to this show, every single moment of it is burned into my memory. So we are going to bring on our friend this happened to be his first fish show. And that person is named Benji Eisen. So we're going to bring him in. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was also going to say, as I bring Benji in from the waiting room, that Benji was there and I was also there. And we might have evidence of that if you listen carefully to the antelope, but we can talk about that later. If you've listened to the past couple seasons of Undermine, then you're already familiar with today's guest. He's been our head writer since season 2, and he's currently an executive producer of the show. But more visibly, he's often my co-host. He's written about fish for Rolling Stone and many other publications over the years, and he's worked directly with Trey during Fare Thee Well. And having a show host as our special guest feels a little bit like cheating, but welcome back, Benji.
Thanks for having me, guys. Hi, RJ.
Hey, man. Good to see you on this side of the mic or this side of the camera or whatever it is.
It's good to be here together.
We're all on the same side of the table. So the table's like leaning this way, which is weird. You've seen close to 400 shows, but you always remember your first. And 12/31/93 was your first?
It was. My first was supposed to be earlier that summer. I had tickets to Wolf Trap and I made it so far as the parking lot in a misadventure. Delayed my first show until this time. However, what that did though is in the interim between then, I became a fish fan after I was supposed to see them and didn't at Wolf Trap. And right before this, so going into New Year's Eve 93, I knew nothing about Game Henger, nothing about fish lore or culture, but I had at that point been familiar with Junta and with Picture of Nectar.
Got it. And talking about firsts, I believe all the shows that we've covered, and we're now on episode 8, as I mentioned, I went to one surrounding the shows in some cases, like the State Theater before the show that we talked about with Brad Sands at the Field House in New Hampshire. But I was not at any of the shows so far until this one. So this is also a first for me, Benji, 12/31/93.
I saw you there, even though I didn't know you or meet you yet, and we'll get to that.
Did I have a ticket stub in my hand?
I don't believe so, no. You had a microphone.
Benji, what was the... So we should talk about 12:30 as well, and we'll talk about the music, but what was the scene like as you rolled into the Worcester Centrum? I mean, this is like a... This is a big show for fish. I assume it was a big show for a lot of fans.
Yeah. So going into it, you know, a big theme for this night that plays into the way the entire night unfolded for me was just I had no context, it being my first fish show. However, I did see, you know, this was New Year's Eve 93. So I had been seeing the Grateful Dead since 91. So I was acclimated to the idea of the scene, you know. However, my impression going into the Worcester Centrum that night was it was cold. It was really, really cold. I think it was snow on the ground if there weren't flurries in the air. But I remember, this is one of those rare shows where I can remember the parking lot we parked in and the entrance that I went into. And because of how freezing cold it was outside, I remember there was an issue getting inside, which I think Trey even recognizes from the stage.
Everybody in yet?
So I didn't really see any vending or any visible signs until leaving. When I left that night, I remember people were selling things like bumper stickers that said free Game Henge. And I had no idea what that meant. I just thought it confirmed my suspicion that this band invented their own universe and certainly their own language.
Their own religion. Yeah.
Yeah. Their own religion.
I always wondered when, when that special language worked perfectly. And especially the one where they do that do, 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 and everyone, and sometimes, or when people all turn around, the turn, turn, turn one, that people coming to their first show they must just wonder, how in the world could what just happened happen? And you had like that happening in spades, because this was New Year's Eve and there was also a gag happening. So you must have thought every show was like that. Tell us about the New Year's Eve gag.
That's right. Well, so I walk into the venue and, you know, like I said, I'd been familiar. I had some live tapes, but a lot of it was like filler, Ungrateful Dead tapes and things like that. So I would say that Junta was what captivated me, and you enjoy myself particularly, but this does answer your question. But Llama, the first time I heard Phish was Picture of Nectar, and they were described to me as a Grateful Dead version of Red Hot Chili Peppers, which makes no sense, but then the first song's Llama, and that actually kind of does make sense. And the first song this night was Llama, but which I thought was a nice little, you know, synchronicity. But overall, walking into it, the stage looked like an aquarium, and not in the way that Madison Square Garden was turned into an aquarium this past April, because the entire venue was. But this night, it was just the stage. It looked like a fish tank. There was, you know, like seaweed and things like that over the amplifiers and over the monitors, rather, on the floor, a giant clamshell. And without any context, I thought, oh, this is their production. This is what they do. This is their touring setup. And then for the gag, by the end of You Enjoy Myself, which of course I was thrilled to hear live, with that being the song that grabbed me in, by the end of it, they put on a wetsuit. And I'm like, oh, this is just, you know, normal fare for the band. And then, and also it being my first show, I'll say that I was definitely on psychedelics and, you know, young and starry eyed. And so for New Year's Eve, in between sets, you know, they had this thing on the PA system right before the actual New Year's gag. And that's that they had these like burbling bubbles sounding like underwater. I thought that Phish had this technology that turned the entire arena into this underwater, you know, like sound. So, you know, and I at this point, I lost my friends. They were up on the 100 section, and I just was so enthralled with the music from the very beginning note that somehow I ended up in the front 10 rows. And this was not general admission. There were seats, and somehow I had a seat. Like, I don't know. It just was like one of these magical things. I was like within 10 rows, a seat to myself, but no one I knew around me. And all I could hear from the chatter was blah, 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 blah. So when people tried to be nice to me and ask me questions, I figured I'll play along. And I looked at them and I'd be like, blah, 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 blah. which I probably shouldn't have said, but that's fine. That's how the night went. And then they came down from the ceiling in these wetsuits and swam down, and they entered the clam once they got to the ground, the bottom of the aquarium, as it were. And the clam rises up and explodes as Happy New Year's, and the band's on stage jamming. Then I realized, well, that part is the gag. You know, that part's special for New Year's Eve. But the aquarium, I left that night thinking, yeah, they play in an aquarium and they set everything up like an aquarium, and they sing about down beneath the seaweed and the slime. And
you must have been so disappointed when you went to your next show. You were asking people like, blah, 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 blah. And where's the aquarium? Everyone was probably like, who is this guy?
Totally.
That's amazing. Well, Benji, we should talk a little bit about 1993, because we've done a few other shows from 93, and this was like a huge, huge year. I think in the 1230 and 1231 93 shows, I hear a lot of progression, you know, even from spring and summer 93. It seems like they were just progressing so fast. And this whole show sounds like a celebration. Looking back on it now, how do you think this falls in like the history of Phish in terms of a New Year's show and kind of the end of a big year?
I think Trey actually accidentally summarizes it at the very end of this night, because he says, well, it's been 10 years for us. And I, you know, at the time that blew my mind too, because they were a brand new phenomenon for me. You know, I had been aware of them for less than a year. So, but it also explained why they could be an arena and why everyone seemed to know the secret language and a secret handshake, you know, metaphorically speaking. And then Trey says, you know, I hope you'll be with us for another 10 more. And of course, here we are 30 years later, almost still listening. but yeah, I mean, I thought it was a punctuation mark on, you know, and now that I've gone back and obsessively heard, you know, hours and hours and hours of Phish before this night, I think it does sum up 1993 really well, but it also is a very good summation of the first 10 years of the band. I mean, I think Amy's Farm was the first summation and a great, you know, landmark, you know, goalpost or whatever. And then this one. And after New Year's Eve 93, if you wanted to introduce somebody to Phish and you wanted to kind of show off what they can do musically, you probably would give them 1231-93 with the companion of 1230 that we're about to talk about, because that one also has the Colonel Forbin narration, which to me was such a wonderful side of Phish that, you know, just to me played to all the things that he ever wanted out of a band, that they could jam and yet they didn't take themselves too seriously. They could tell these psychedelic stories. And then later on in 1230 and from Portland, they do Purple Rain. So, you know, but with Fishman doing it and the Vacuum Cleaner solo. So after doing a Mite song and some like amazing improvisational music, then they also have this humorous side where they show that they don't take themselves too seriously while playing really serious music. And that to me just checked all the boxes.
That makes a lot of sense. I think the 1230 show, there's a little bit more like serious improv in there. You know, I think to me, the Bowie and the Mike stand out as really like what those two songs would become in terms of improv. You know, like the Bowie feels light years ahead of even the 5893 Bowie that we talked about with Brad, and the Mike's has this thrilling melodic jam that almost is like extending the way that they think about improv in that particular song. I feel like those two songs on 1230 are really representative of where those both will go in 94, which is like so far beyond that.
RJ, you're right. In the 1230 Bowie that you're talking about, the previous show that we did here at Undermine with the Murat Djinn also has a Bowie that is phenomenal and long. And if you listen to that and then you listen to this with the Dream On, and I think it really shows Phish's flexibility at the time and how when they were improvising, they weren't just changing up their solo. They were actually improvising.
Tom, we need to hear about your experience from 1231. Maybe we should we take a quick break before we get into this? Because Tom has a slightly different experience from us from 1231-93.
Yeah, let's take a break. Like any good TV show, we teased what's about to happen. So let's take a quick break and we'll be back with all this and more. And we are back, and I'm here with my co-host, RJB, and our special guest today is Benji Eisen. Benji, we are talking about the 1230 and also the 1231 shows, and could you give us highlights, I think specifically from the New Year's show?
Well, from the New Year's show, I think that the obvious highlight to me was that they did a Down With Disease jam out of Auld Lang Syne that was, at the time, nobody knew what it was. It was Phish from the future, which I think is the point of them playing it, right? You know, in the very beginning, the first minute of the new year. a song that would become so important to them beginning that year. And then the other thing too was Frank Zappa had died earlier that month in early December, and they played Peaches and Regalia, but then it became a recurring theme throughout the show, and they teased it multiple times. And I think that, you know, as an homage to Frank Zappa, I didn't know that at the time. I thought it was a riff that Phish had created. And so there was also that double layer for me later on discovering that. But, you know, there are just a lot of highlights. And I'll tell you another one was when I saw them, when they played Run Like an Antelope live. And Tom, I know that, you know, I know that today I'm not the co-host, I'm the guest, but I've got a question for you on the subject of being a special guest. You know, as we said, this was my first show, so everything was kind of brand new to me, and I didn't really know how typical Phish shows went. I didn't even know that they had a lyricist like the Grateful Dead had Robert Hunter. But all of a sudden, you know, they're playing this Run Like an Antelope. They're blowing my mind with it. And then, you know, I saw you. I think I maybe even heard your name when Trey pulled you on stage, and he said, "Here to sing the first lyrics that you ever wrote for Phish," which, of course, as you know, was...
I'll say it. Rai Rai Rocco, Marco Escondolas. Been you to have any spike, man?
Well,
there's a lot of things I have to say about this. First of all, I don't think that they're the first lyrics I ever wrote for Phish. They may have been the first recorded... No. I think the first I ever wrote might be Mackie Super Policeman, and then Trey and I, you know, way back before even Phish, I think, had been drumming on the rhombus and coming up with, like, Divided Sky. And then, like, in his dad's basement, we did Iculus or McGrupp. But it all blends together in my head. But the interesting thing about this song is I get credit for this song. But this is really a Dude of Life, Steve Pollack, and Trey song, The Antelope. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And that was in Trey's basement, I think in 1983 or late 82 or 83, when he all of a sudden said, "There needs to be something right here," and shoved a mic in my face after, I think, you know, a bong hit or something. And I was in the room with Dobbs, Mark Daubert, who eventually wrote with Trey The Curtain and became the band's first percussionist along with Fishman in Burlington a little bit later. But he was standing there, and I had no idea what to say. And I just said, for some reason, "Rai Rai Rocco." And I looked at Mark, and I said, "Marco Escuandolas." And again, I don't know why. And then I said, "Been you to have any spleef, man?" Like the Rasta spliff. Spleef. But then the weird thing is, anytime Trey ever said it on stage, as far as I know, he said spike instead of spliff. So that's a weird little bit of trivia.
I'll tell you that night watching you from the stage at my first show, I thought this always happens, but I also thought it confirmed my suspicion because of those specific lyrics. Confirm my suspicion that, of course, Phish had their own language and their own universe, you know?
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get a little special guest out here at this moment right now. Here to sing the first line that he ever wrote for a Phish song, would you please welcome the one and only Mr. Tom Marshall.
Sing it, Tom. Marco Escuandolas. Been you to have any spike, man?
Exactly. So we need a Phish scholar to tell us which actually was my first stage appearance with Phish, but the reason that the fact that I had switched to from spleef to spike, and I think I alternate in subsequent appearances, but that tells me that this is not my first time I did this. And Trey had given me this blanket idea where he said, anytime you're in the audience and we play Antelope and you come to the side stage, and if I catch your eye and give you a nod, come on and do this part, no matter where we are or when. And I took him at his word, literally, all the way up until 2012, when he didn't expect me and I stormed the stage at SPAC. But that's another story. I don't think I ever got a nod from him and went on anyway. But that's, you know, that was the last of those.
That's amazing. I got to say, this show, and Benji, I'm sure you have additional thoughts. This show, for me, I got a lot of play in my car. I mentioned at the beginning, you know, the radio broadcast is part of it, right? We just had these amazing high-quality tapes. I remember driving around with a friend in probably 1995 listening to Reba. And since that one time when it really, like, hit me, it's really, like, my go-to Reba, which I don't, you know, there are a lot of great Rebos from 94, 95, and onward, but the sound quality, the way it hit me, and it's a good version too, but this Reba always is sort of a go-to for me.
The Reba, I mean, the whole night has this flow to it, right? I mean, of course, we're going to get to the big New Year's Eve show of the era, which was 12/31/95. But I feel like there's a very similar parallel here. You know, there was that split open amount. There's the lizards, the sparkle, the way that the show flowed. And this is one of the reasons why I think that we're talking about this show to this day. We're not talking about it because of the Yad. Even though being there, the Yad to me was like the thing that, like, you know, blows your mind and you think about later on, you know, or at least, you know, from a theatrical standpoint. But musically, I mean, you know, as we talked about the highlights earlier, the Peaches and the Down with the Z's jam, the split open amount, the Run Like an Antelope. And then, of course, it also had a Henrietta, a Fishman moment, and also confirming my suspicion that they have their own language. He came out with these cymbals. And on the one symbol was ah, and on the other symbol was B. And so, of course, the song begins with an ah, ah, trapped one rosy. And then, of course, it culminates with a ba, 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 ba. So it held up both of the symbols. And I also, of course, thought, well, they must do this at every show. They have the ba symbols.
So your second fish, tell me it wasn't a letdown. It had to have been a letdown.
No, but because I mean, I dove in. I think I went on Fish, you know, Fish Net, okay. Rec Music Fish, and
good.
So I was well acclimated by then.
Because you arrived at like a, I mean, Fish was hitting peaks all the time, but you arrived at arguably a peak at that moment. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to come down off a peak, but Fish was peaking constantly.
That so 12/31/92 was a Boston show at Northeastern. That was the last New Year's Eve show without any gag, right? That was just like Trey counting down. So this really kicked off a new tradition for Fish. And is there a better Auld Lang Syne transition than this? Because this, it's so iconic, and it's like the segue is perfect. The energy is so high, and it's so fun to listen to. Still, like to go back and just listen to that into the Down with Disease jam. Do you remember what it was like in the arena for that moment? Because I assume, like you said, a lot of people didn't know what it was. But now when we listen back, it seems like it would have just, everyone would have been losing their minds. But maybe people were more confused.
No, it was glorious chaos in that. Well, at first for Auld Lang Syne, that's one that I knew, you know, everybody knows that song, you know, and I was kind of happy that they did it. Of course, I was sitting by myself with my friends up in the 100s. And then so everyone's, you know, doing their New Year's kiss and they're hugging and their friends and they're saying Happy New Year's. And I'm there going, blah, blah, blah. You know, but it was very celebratory. And the Down With Disease jam, you don't need to ever hear Down With Disease to know how celebratory and victorious that sounds. It's kind of like designed that way, right? It sounds like a victory. It sounds like this just, you know, amazing thing. And so it sounded natural. I just thought that it was probably a piece of improvisation. And I think that a lot of people there, because it comes right out of the Old Lane Sign, so it sounds like they're going right into some piece of improv. And that later on, maybe you can, you know, I know that Fish in, at a later point in their career would sometimes write songs by going into jams and finding riffs that they, you know, hit upon. So it's kind of sounded like that. It wasn't until a few months later that everyone realized that it was actually, you know, from a composition. And so the venue, as you said, RJ, it was a big venue for them. I remember that was part of the appeal for me going up for them on New Year's. I took the train from Pennsylvania up to see them. And I was like, it was a big deal. Even I knew that it was a big deal that they were in an arena. And I was like, well, this is kind of, this feels like a cultural moment that I have to be, you know, I have to see, I have to be a part of. And there was that feeling inside that room that night. You know, people were dressed up for New Year's. Some people were dressed up in tuxes and, like, you know, nice things like that. Other people were just dressed as the early version of the Fish prototype, but, you know, celebratory. I feel like, I don't know if people get dressed up for New Year's Eve like that anymore, the way that that night, I just remember a lot of people were really dressed up as if they're going to a New Year's Eve party, because they were. And I remember the energy in that room was absolutely bonkers, you know. And I knew, you know, I'd never been to Fish, but having been to the Grateful Dead, you're in a very parallel situation, the way that it might look without having any audio, just the way that it looks from afar. But in that room that night, it wasn't at all like a Grateful Dead concert, because it was this very concerted energy. And just, you know, people just celebrating life.
This, you talk about people dressing up. My form of dressing up is putting a button-down shirt over a t-shirt. And I possibly was wearing this one. This I had to dig way down into my drawer, and I found a 1.0 shirt that I very well might have been wearing as a t-shirt that night. And I have to go back and look at video of myself up on stage during Antelope. But guys, can we talk about the night before Portland, Maine? I know you weren't there, Benji, but I'm sure you've listened a lot now. What are your thoughts about that? You already mentioned the Colonel Forbin narration and the specialness of that.
Yeah, the Colonel Forbin narration, I mean, 1230-93 is a show that I must have gotten on tape very shortly after this New Year's show. It was one of the first tapes that I got. And it was one of those ones that, along with 1231-93, is a prototype. You know, it really is a great, those two combined were a great, they're great companion pieces. They pair well because they show off all of the sides of Fish. And I know that this entire, you know, by the way, even though I you know, I make fun of myself for thinking that Fish had this aquarium every night, they actually did have the aquarium every night of this tour. And that includes two dates beforehand, one in Washington, D.C., and one in New Haven, which they also, during those nights, played Peaches and Regalia a lot and teased it, and an Old Lane Sign, in terms of making the New Year's run one cohesive whole. But I feel that the show 1230 in Maine the Forbin narration to me was really, I just, you know, like how original of a thing. No other band was doing anything like that. It really, you know, it appealed to the theatrical. It appealed to, you know, the spectacle side of things. And also the mites from that night. But I really think that, as RJ was saying, the David Bowie from that night is heads and shoulders above any. It was such a great punctuation on the period by also putting its best foot forward and coming up with some of the best versions of these songs to date, you know, to that date.
Yeah, absolutely. Just incredible run of shows. I mean, those two shows back to back, and coming off, like we talked about, an amazing year, you know, before those, the DC, New Haven, Portland, and Worcester shows was the last show before that was the Greek show from August, right? Which was another amazing show. So they were just really, as Brad Sands kind of said in about the May 8th show, they were just on fire the entire show. I mean, they played hundreds of shows, and not every one, but the ratio of amazing shows is really high for this era.
It is. And they, as you just said, RJ, they had off that fall, and they finished the Greek Theater out west. And then I believe, I'd have to look this up to confirm it, but I believe they must have been working on Hoist then during that period, you know. And then, of course, because the Hoist was released just a few months later after these shows. And Down with Disease was the showcase piece that they kind of did in a very fishy fashion, debuted it in a way that nobody knew they were debuting it.
So awesome. I just, before we wrap up, we haven't really talked about set two of 1231 and just the bookends of a great Tweezer and a great You Enjoy Myself is, just a great three set show, but those, and a great Hood to kind of close the third set before Tweezer Reprise. It's just an amazing, I'm really glad I got to go back to the show, even though I've listened to it so many times, but it's always such a thrill.
Going back to the show, for our listeners, by the way, is worth it for that Hood. The Hood is a dark horse. It gets forgotten about, you know, because there are so many amazing Hoods out there, but it's really worth listening to.
This is going to be an amazing show. If all this music is mixed in, that would be an endless, endless show. I know that the, you know, our editor Matt is going to put in a few musical selections, which we don't know what they are right now. I can't wait to listen to this episode to hear if he, you know, what suggestions he takes. And that's kind of the interesting thing about us. Well, we're a good team here, and we've got it simple.
It's going to be Vincent Sullivan, isn't it?
With a little roundabout tease.
And there was a Yes tease. Where was that? Oh, no, that wasn't. That was Starship Trooper. Where was that? It was acoustic. And I think that was last episode's show. Sorry about that. Anyway, thank you, Benji. And thank you, RJ. And thanks, everyone out there in podcast land, for joining us. Whether you're watching us on YouTube or listening to us on your stereo, remember to review and subscribe wherever you listen or watch. We'll see you in 15 minutes or at least a couple days. Until then, don't do anything we wouldn't do. And thank you, Benji, and thank you, RJ.
Osiris.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are The Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.